Okay, leave your glasses, Jim. I had a couple up here and they're gone. Blah, blah, blah. May have to turn all these other ones off. All right, I have two stories, both true. I was 9 or 10 or something like that, and you know how you can be obsessed with something, all of a sudden you discover you're obsessed with something, but you don't really remember when it started? You know what I'm talking about? So when I was 9 and 10, I discovered at some point, somehow, that my tongue was messing around with my tooth. You know, and I had been doing it for some time, and then I became aware of it. And you know, once your tongue finds something in your mouth to mess with, it just keeps doing it. And I discovered that my tooth was loose. It was the first one that I had loose. So I went to my parents and said, you know, what's happening? And they explained that you lose all your baby teeth, and then they get replaced with permanent teeth. And that's all they said. I think parents really have to wise up. You have to say more than that, because the kid's going to walk away going, does my arm fall off? It's a baby arm, and then you grow a new one, or you know what? You know, way more explanation on the parental part. But anyway, so I messed with it all day long, and you know, you start digging at it, and you know, they said, well, it has to come out, and so you know, I was going to pull it out. So you know how you take your fingernails and you get under there. But I couldn't do it. Right? It's like, how do you rip something out of your person? So eventually my dad took a thread and he wrapped it around there, tied it to the door handle, and then you just slam the door and out it comes. Yeah, it's surprisingly hard to remove things, even things you don't want. Second story. My kids were 9, 7, and 5, and 3, I guess. And we just got a new volleyball net, and we set it up in the backyard. And so we're playing volleyball, and, you know, I got a few really good spikes in on my 9 and 7 and 5 and 3-year-old. There had been some building project near that, and I kind of went off to the side, and I stepped on a board that had a spike sticking through it, so right on my foot. And when I picked up my foot, the 2x4 came up, and you know it pierced through because it hurts a little bit, but you don't know how far, right? So there it was on the bottom of my foot, and what do? It's like, do you just pull it out? It took a little courage to pull it out. By the way, How many of you here with a Band-Aid just rip it off, and how many do the slow thing where you just carefully, little by little by little, take it off? Okay. And then how many of you just rip it off? Okay. How many have never had a Band-Aid on at all, ever in their life? Now, of those that just rip it off, raise your hands again, those that just rip it off. How many, keep your hands up, how many of you, the people that rip it off, also jump right into the water without, you know, slowly going in? Well, I thought those might be related, but apparently not. Okay. It's surprisingly difficult to remove things that we don't like. That's the next step that we're looking at. Step 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. We're looking at the 12 steps, and in a way, the 12 steps are really about the doctrine of sanctification. It's not so much about how to get saved. It's really the next step. Once you're saved, how do you improve as a person? How do you improve as a parent? How do you improve your marriage? How do you improve as a person? How do you become more and more like Christ? That's the process we call sanctification. Sanctification comes from the Latin word sanctus, which means holy. And the process of sanctification requires some work. Salvation is the free gift of God. Jesus won that for us on the cross. But sanctification, the process of becoming a better person, requires effort and work, much like, you know, if you want to learn how to play the piano. But surprisingly, even though it requires work on our part, God is largely responsible for our sanctification as well. He saves us, and then he helps us become what he wants us to be, and we'll come back to that in a little bit. So step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of characters. I want to look at three key words out of that. First key word is remove. Ready to have God remove things. One of the Proverbs goes like this: sometimes it takes a painful situation to make us change our ways. Isn't that true?
Sure.
Debt. You know, you're not very good with money. Guess what the pain is? Pain is debt. Broken relationships, marriage, family, and friends, workmates. The pain of sin in our lives, the pain of the things in our lives that we don't like, is that we end up with broken relationships. Health problems, you know, the bad habits of eating, not exercising, all those things end up in health problems. Our priorities get messed up. Doubts, fears, depression, anger issues. So we can leave the things that we've been talking about last week. We talked about making a moral inventory, looking at your life. We looked at the seven connections. What's your relationship to God? What's your relationship to a spouse if you're married? What's your relationship to your family, your kids, or your parents? What's your relationship to your friends? What's your relationship to church, the kingdom, the world, God? You know, we looked at all those things, and hopefully you made a list. Where are you coming up short? Well, you know, you can come up with that list, but often you don't do anything unless it's painful enough. It's interesting. The 12 steps was started many years ago by two men who had been struggling, and eventually, they wrote what AA people call the Big Book. And it's called the Big Book because it's a big book. And it's the whole story. It's a fascinating story. And in the Big Book, one of the stories told is, I think it was there's Bill and Dr. Bob, or the other way around. And one of them, a lady came and begged him to go visit her husband who had a drinking problem, and it was so bad that he was hospitalized. So she came to him and begged him, please go in and talk to him and see if you can turn him around, tell your story, whatever it takes. So he went to the hospital and he went into the room, and she wasn't inside the room, and he was in there for maybe 4 minutes. Then he came out. And then she said, "Well, 4 minutes. I mean, you know, what? You know, did you talk to him? Did you show him the error of his ways?" And he just looked at her and said, "He's not ready. He's not ready. It's not painful enough." And that's true of most of our lives. Most things we do not change until it becomes painful enough. Spiritual wilderness. Okay, second key word, ready. Ready. First problem is I don't really want to change. There are all these things in my life, but I don't really want to change them. From 2 Timothy 3, 2 through 4, people will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, gossipy, without self-control, can't go by the fast food restaurant without stopping in, brutal, not lovers of good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Notice, you can't see it that well, but I highlighted one word in yellow. Lovers. See, the problem is we love the things that we don't want to let go. We love complaining. I mean, if that's your thing, You don't want to give that up. Because when you're complaining about everything around you, somehow it makes you feel good. Talking about people negatively behind their back. You know, when you're in a group of people and they're all doing that, how do you feel? Don't you feel superior? Like, I'm not those people I'm talking about. Look at them. They're this. They do this. Remember, did you see what they did? Did you see what they said? Did you see what they did? You see, we all are having a good time talking about someone, putting them low. And at the same time, what does that do for us? It lifts us high. Do I want to give that up? Fixing people, I end up feeling good. Critical attitude. Now, what you know, you look at me and you might say I have a critical attitude. I look at you and say I just tell the truth. And I'm so smart and so superior to you that I can see the truth that you can't see. So I'm doing you a favor. See, do I want to let go of that? Part of who I am, part of the self-esteem, the reason that I feel good about myself is because I see things other people don't see, and it's no fun seeing those things without saying them. Now, from the other side, it sounds like it's just a critical attitude, and you're just beating me up. See, do I want to let go of that? Smoking, drinking, surfing. Do you know what surfing is? Yeah, something to do with the internet. Shopping, eating, mindlessly watching TV. You know what I'm talking about? I don't know what your vice is. I don't know what your struggle is, but there's a reason why you hold on to it. I'm on the Jeff Weinstein diet. I don't know if you know Jeff. Jeff is in our church, and it's kind of a low-carb thing. Don't eat the carbs and so on. Problem is, I love pizza. I'm a lover of pizza. Do I really want to give it up? Do I want to let it go? Fighting, yelling, screaming. Some of you, that's your marriage relationship go-to. Honey, let's communicate. And I'm going to yell, I'm going to scream. Often that's the way parents, you know, you tell the kids once, and then what do? You yell and you scream. And somehow the yelling and the screaming and the anger, the venting, helps. Do you want to give that up? I mean, in some ways you want to give it up. On the other hand, it does something for you. That's why you do it. Okay, the things that we do things for us. Do you want to give them up? So I don't want to change. And number two, others don't want me to change. That's what's really strange. Others don't want me to change. I was just reading through the book of Nehemiah the other day, and Nehemiah was building the walls of Jerusalem. The walls had been destroyed 70 years earlier, and he came to rebuild Jerusalem. And all the neighboring people, once they started the project, didn't want them to. I mean, you would think they'd want to clean the place up. You know, they're living in sort of a wasteland, and things are starting to take shape and become in order, but the more in shape they became, the more threatened everyone was around them. Now, that sort of makes sense, I guess. You know, they don't know what the new thing is going to be and their position and so on. But you know, the same thing happens in our lives. I remember the first time I discovered this in marriage counseling. The woman from my church came and said, you know, my husband is a bump on the log. He's not going to church. You know, we can't talk about anything. He's like dead. He just doesn't, you know, we have nothing in common. And it's like totally frustrating. So then I went to him, and I used to play ping pong with him a little bit. I talked to him. Hey, why don't we just have a conversation? Just come on in to the office. He finally comes into the office. But then he wouldn't say anything. You know, they would sit, you know, I'd be here, they would sit here, and she would sit facing me, and he would sit with his chair kind of the other way. And we tried to engage him, you know, this, and she would tell her side of the thing, so what do you got to say? Nothing. He just wouldn't, it's like, you know, and she was right, he just was like a dead fish. I mean, he just wouldn't engage. So after one session, it was like, well, this was fun. Let's do this again next week. So They came next week, and the same thing. And finally, one more week, the third week, you know, we're talking, and all of a sudden, he literally turned his chair in. He turned his chair in, and he started talking. And he started sharing. And he started saying, like, his point. Okay, so it was like 3 weeks we've been waiting for this chair to turn around. And you know what she did? She just smacked him. I mean, she just unloaded both barrels at him. And I'm like, what? What are we doing here? It took us 3 weeks to get him to turn the chair, and now, bam! I mean, she had been 3 weeks before. Nice. Come on, honey. Let's do this. I really want to work this work. It was all sweet and soft and everything else. The minute he turned, pow! I remember walking away going, what happened here? And then, I figured it out. It was this. People want you to change, but they don't. Eventually, we get used to each other, and we end up coping with all the crazy stuff in our lives, and we are more threatened when that's going to change, even if it's for the better. We're used to the stuff. And that, you know, and that's why when people grow up in dysfunctional families, when they create one of their own, they just repeat the same thing because it's what they know. And there's some comfort in what you know. So a lot of times we're not ready to give things up, and neither are the people around us. Third key word, God. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects from us. I highlighted the word God. Well, how does this happen? Step one, we admitted we were powerless over the effects of our separation from God, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our lives over to God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God and to ourselves and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Notice, four out of the five steps deal with God. Isn't that interesting? I told the story of when I visited an AA meeting, and I was a fly on the wall, and afterwards the guy came up to me and he said, don't sweat the God stuff. And the reason he said that is because God keeps showing up. I mean, four out of the five steps. So that's what I meant at the beginning when I said the process of sanctification requires some effort and work on our part, but do you notice that God is a part of every part of it? God is helping you. He's wanting you to overcome these things. And then we have step seven. Humbly asked him, again God, to remove our shortcomings. Well, how might God remove our shortcomings? How does he do that? Number one, by removing the guilt. Psalm 32, verse 5, we read it a week ago. This is King David. Then I acknowledged my sin and did not cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. The problem with guilt is we never hold on to it long. I mean, maybe some of you were raised with guilt. Maybe you had parents that were always telling you how you should be, and you know, God wouldn't be pleased with that, or, you know. And maybe some of you are here this morning because if you weren't here this morning, you'd feel guilty about it. Guilt is actually a good thing. Guilt can keep you doing the things that you should do. But the problem with guilt, the problem with using guilt, is no one sits around and feels guilty very long. Guilt is such a powerful force that we always morph it into something else. So you end up feeling guilty, and then it morphs into anger. It's really interesting. Guilt morphs into anger. And anger goes one of two places. A lot of times, the guilt that you feel morphs into anger, and then it gets thrown at the people around you. It's like when you come home and kick the dog because you had a bad day. It's you know, like for example, a lot of parents feel guilty about their parenting. I mean, when it comes right down to, if you ask them, how are you as a parent? What are you doing? Yeah, there's a lot of things I could do better. So they feel guilty about their parenting. And then when they see their kids mess up, they express the guilt that they have for themselves, the anger, and they take it out on the kid. Why? Because you're reminding me of what kind of lousy parent I am. So anger, or when you get angry and you look at people, you're getting angry at people at work, you're angry. If you have an issue with anger, it's often an issue with guilt. And you take it out on other people rather than yourself. So that's one way anger goes. Anger goes out. The other option is to take the anger that guilt morphs into and turn it in yourself. Yeah, I am a schmuck. Yeah, I can't do anything right. I am so worthless. I'm quitting. I'm not trying. I'm not doing anything anymore. No, don't ask me because I can't do, you know? And it's that kind of, I feel guilty, but instead of feeling guilty, I turn it into anger, and then I push the anger onto me. I am worthless. I am no good. And then what happens is, when I do that, people around me come up to me and say, no, you're okay, you're good. Really? Yeah. Okay? So it's a way that I'm trying to fix myself. Okay? But it doesn't get rid of the guilt. Then I acknowledge my sin to you, did not cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. It was interesting, our small group meeting, we had a long discussion somehow. I don't know if it had anything to do with what we were studying or not. But we were talking about punishment versus discipline. And does God punish his people? It was an interesting discussion because you have to first figure out the difference between punishment and discipline. Punishment is something you deserve because you did something. And the goal is to sort of make it even, right? So you commit a crime and they punish you by sending you to jail. It's a punishment. It's not there to discipline you. It's there to punish you. You did this and you must pay. And so the discussion went like this. Well, does God punish his children? Well, it feels like it, doesn't it, sometimes? When things go bad. But I think we decided, I don't know if we really came down with anything. I think what we finally came down with is, no, God does not punish his own people. He disciplines them. Discipline, the goal of discipline is to make something better. Okay? The goal of punishment is to pay what you owe, and Jesus already paid what we owe. See, that's the guilt. I guess I'm bringing this up because guilt has been paid for. The guilt of our sin is paid on the cross for us. You don't have to carry the guilt. Now, you're going to get disciplined by God, and sometimes you do foolish things. If you eat all the chocolate of Deet and Lori, and you get a sore stomach, whoever did that, you know, you're going to suffer. But that's discipline, okay? I'm trying to make you a better person. Well, how might God remove our shortcomings? Number two, by allowing the pain to increase. He does that, doesn't he? Psalm 20, 32, 3 and 4, these are the two verses before the ones we just read. When I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy on me, and my strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. So God is not going to, if you're a believer, God is not going to punish you, but he is going to discipline you. He's going to allow you to experience the results of your poor choices. So all the things that we hold on to, all our defects of character that we want to hang on to, often he uses the pain that those things cause to make us change our ways. And finally, number three, how might God remove our shortcomings? By removing them in his time. 1 Peter 5:6, if you will humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, in his good time, he will lift you up. So maybe you're struggling with certain things in your life. This step is suggesting that you become willing, first of all, to let go of them. If you're not willing to let go of them, then you're going to just hang on to them. But if you're willing to let go of them, that's step six. Step seven is to humbly bring them to God. To just, at some point, you have to give up. You've been trying. Some of these things that you struggle with, you've been trying on your own. You've been working at it. You've been, okay, today I'm going to really concentrate. And then you end up messing up. At some point, you have to let go and say, you know, I can't do it. I have to give them to God. God, if I'm going to be able to do anything, it's going to be up to you because I can't do this. But then, you know, the problem is you did that. You know, last year you did that. You gave it to God. You said, here it is, God. Whew, I did exactly what the pastor said. Now I can go to sleep. And the next day you end up doing the thing all over again. It's like, okay, giving things to God does not work. How many of you haven't felt that way? He removes them in his time. If you humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, in his good time, he will lift you up. Maybe you still need to be disciplined by that problem a little bit longer. Psalm 66, verse 10. For you, O Lord, O God, tested us. You refined us like silver. That refining process is a tough one. I found this old thing. It's called On the Anvil. It's written by Max Lucado, and I don't know which book that I lifted out of years ago, but I want to read it because I think it talks about really how God shapes and molds us through our problems. With a strong forearm, the apron-clad blacksmith puts his tongs into the fire. He grasps the heated metal and places it on the anvil. His keen eye examines the glowing piece. He sees what the tool is now, and he envisions what he wants it to be. Sharper, flatter, whiter, longer. With a clear picture in his mind, he begins to pound, his left hand clutching the hot mass with the tongs. And the right hand slams the 2-pound sledge upon the moldable metal. On the solid anvil, the smoldering iron is remolded. The smith knows the type of instrument he wants. He knows the size. He knows the shape. He knows the strength. Whang! Whang! The hammer slams. The shop rings with noise. The air fills with smoke, and the softened metal responds. But the response doesn't come easily. It doesn't come without discomfort. To melt down the old and to recast it as new is a disrupting process. Yet the metal remains on the anvil, allowing the toolmaker to remove the scars, repair the cracks, refill the voids, and purge the impurities. And with time, a change occurs. What was dull becomes sharpened. What was crooked becomes straight. What was weak becomes strong. What was useless becomes valuable. Then the blacksmith stops. He ceases his pounding and sets down his hammer. With a strong left arm, he lifts the tongs until the freshly molded metal is at eye level. In the still silence, he examines the smoking tool. The incandescent implement is rotated, examined for any mars or cracks. There are none. Now the smith enters the final stage of his task. He plunges the smoldering instrument into a nearby bucket of water. With a hiss and a rush of smoke, the metal immediately begins to harden. The heat surrenders to the onslaught of the cool water, and the pliable, soft mineral becomes an unbending, useful tool. On God's anvil. Perhaps you've been there, melted down, formless, undone, placed on the anvil for reshaping. I've been on it. It's rough. It's a spiritual slump. It's a famine. The fire goes out. Although the fire may flame for a moment, it soon disappears. We drift downward, downward into a foggy valley of question, a misty lowland of discouragement. Motivation wanes. Desire is distant. Responsibilities are just depressing. Passion slips out the door. Enthusiasm, gone. Anvil time. It can be caused by a death, a breakup, going broke, or going prayerless. The light switch is flipped off and the room darkens. I hope you're not on the anvil, unless, of course, you need it, then I hope you are. Anvil time is not to be avoided, it's to be experienced. And though it's a long, dark tunnel, it does go through the mountain. Anvil time reminds us of who we are and who God is. We shouldn't try to escape it. To escape it could be to escape from God. God sees our life from beginning to end. He may lead us through a storm at age 30 so we can endure a hurricane at age 60. An instrument is only useful if it's the right shape. A dull axe or a bent screwdriver needs attention, and so do we. A good blacksmith keeps his tools in shape, and so does God. Should God place you on his anvil, be thankful. It means he thinks you're still worth reshaping. Let's pray to God. Lord, some of us are going through an anvil time. We feel that way anyway. And the things of life are pounding on us. Maybe it's things that we're experiencing in our marriage. Maybe it's things that we're experiencing in our family, things we've tried to control, we've tried to make a difference, we've tried to fix it, tried to make it happen, and it just feels like we're being pounded upon. It doesn't get fixed. And the hope of something good is waning. Lord, help us to experience the pain as a motivation to bring these things to you, to get help. We can't do these things on our own. We can't become what you want us to be on our own. It takes your Spirit alive in us. It takes the people of God coming and surrounding us and helping us and doing what they can to help us. It takes the power of your word as we read it and try to bring it to our lives. Lord, we can't do this on our own. Lord, I pray as we struggle, as we become refined, that we keep in mind the goal. Your goal in our life is to make us the best that we can be, to make us good parents, to make us good husbands and good wives, to make us good friends, to make us mission people that make a difference in the lives of the people around us. Lord, help us to endure these times on the anvil, and help it not be a waste. May we get reshaped and remolded so that we become useful tools in your hands. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. This time we're going to have the offering. We are a little bit behind in our budget. We always are, and then we try to catch up in December.